Welcome to Access Advocacy on thepowerofvoices.com. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. The goal of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with the chronic illness of sickle cell disease. Today we're speaking with Bill Cummings. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Adrienne. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. I'm so excited that we're finally getting to do this. I think for now 2 years, I've been saying, let's get together, let's talk. Why don't you tell the audience a bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah, it's been a while since we've seen each other over the years and finally get a chance to sit down and talk. Thanks for inviting me. Let me give you a little bit of background. I'm the father of an adult son, Brandon, who was born with sickle cell disease almost 30 years ago. And when he was born, I knew the possibility of sickle cell, thanks to my father, who back in the 70s made the whole family aware at a reunion, and so we became aware of our sickle cell trait status. And so my first wife and I knew that there was a possibility of having a child with sickle cell disease, but we didn't want to terminate the pregnancy, and it was long and complicated. Why not? I can answer any questions about that if you want. But the bottom line was, when he was tested at birth and found to be negative, we felt overjoyed. We felt we had dodged a bullet. And 9 months later, we would find out that that result was a false negative. And so we were thrust into the experience of having to deal with what sickle cell disease meant. It was Christmas 1988, and we never really had time to kind of grieve, if you will, because we had to come up to speed with what a splenic sequestration episode was, and then one problem after another. But I look back on it, and I think that was trial by fire, so to speak, and ultimately I would become an advocate just because of seeing other families go through experiences that I dealt with 25 years ago and not feel that they had a lot of resources. So that's what drew me into this fight.
So we both had similar backgrounds in that sickle cell was in my family. And my eldest brother had sickle cell, and my mom was very, very aware and had all of us tested. And I had a false negative on my trait status. So I felt like, okay, I'm golden, right? And then when Marissa was born, and it was, again, at 9 months, they came, and I said, that can't be. That's impossible. So that's kind of when I actually started my advocacy right then and there. I was like, well, how can you have a test that gives out a false negative? I mean, what about these tests? So then I had to learn that there were different types of tests. Of course, there's a cheap test and expensive test, and we'd had the cheap test. Marissa was healthy, so I didn't have to go through much like you did with her as an infant to a toddler.
Well, it's funny you say that Brandon was healthy at the time. I think for the benefit of the audience, people should know that with newborn screening, there are different conditions for which you need to know what to do to avoid problems. And some conditions, like PKU, you need to know pretty quickly so that you don't have mental retardation because of feeding the infant the wrong types of foods. But with sickle cell, typically, because of the benefit of fetal hemoglobin, patients don't exhibit symptoms right away. So you've got some time. And so in our case, the first 6 months, we went to a group pediatric practice. All the practitioners were white, and we just didn't think about sickle cell disease. We, for other reasons, decided to go to a solo practitioner, mainly just for having consistent contact with a doctor over the health of Brandon, just the normal baby checkups, et cetera. And immediately this solo practitioner, who happened to be African-American, began to suspect something was wrong with his blood. And so we tried supplementation. That didn't seem to improve his hemoglobin. And then eventually he said, I know he was tested and it was negative, but are you sure? I think we should repeat the test. And so up until that point in time, he really had no symptoms. It was just kind of a silent disease. And it was just something that we thought was something abstract. It was something the doctor noticed in the blood values. But then 2 weeks after the diagnosis, he had his first actual sickle cell episode, the splenic sequestration, which, if your audience knows anything about sickle cell, it's when the spleen begins to turn on the red blood cells, thinking they're like parasites. And so the hemoglobin plummets, and here we were, Christmas 1988, not really able to fully enjoy the season because we're dealing with a life-threatening side effect of a condition that we thought didn't really affect us.
Yeah. You're bringing memories back now. That diagnosis is is abstract, right? It's kind of like, oh, and then you start having to really live with it. And it causes a real shift in your thinking, I think, from that point on. The lens of which you look out or look at your life is altogether different.
Yeah, and I should probably step back a little bit. I'm comfortable using some of the medical terminology, partly because of just being in this battle for so long. But then also, it so happened that the month after my son was diagnosed, and that was December of 88, when he was diagnosed, I started what would be a 25-year career in the pharmaceutical industry. And so it just so happened that many times my son was treated at the accounts that were my customers. And so I had great access. I could take him to the appointments. I could visit with him if he needed to be hospitalized. And so while I was experiencing dealing with sickle cell as a caregiver, I was also learning more about pharmaceuticals and medical terminology and understanding just the pathophysiology of sickle cell disease. And I also had the benefit, looking back on it, I wouldn't have thought it at the time, of living in Cincinnati. And Cincinnati was a crucial place in the world of sickle cell disease because of the penicillin study. You know, people kind of take for granted the advice to give children penicillin who have sickle cell disease because it protects against an overwhelming infection. Well, the principal investigator of that trial was in Cincinnati at the time, and the published study, I think, was a couple years before my son was born, but we got the benefit of that prophylactic penicillin early on, and then I was new in the pharmaceutical industry, so I was learning about this and experiencing it and applying it right away.
I never knew that. Well, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah. So you were like in this, I mean, I'm kind of flipping my life, which was early on with Marissa, I was doing computer stuff and learning about sickle cell and everything apart from that world. So I had like two worlds going on until recently when now I kind of took the big dive into advocacy. But you all along in your life and your son's life have been in that this kind of place of synergy where your work actually helped you in your life. I mean, that's interesting. That is really interesting. And you were able to then not have to make the choice, at least sometimes, that many of us have to, as to am I going to work or am I going to look after my kid today?
Right. And I recognize that situation has been fortunate for Brandon. It wasn't like we didn't have other problems, and that marriage ultimately ended, and so I can talk more about that. But before I go there, one of the benefits of being in Cincinnati, and it was Dr. Marilyn Gadsden who was the principal investigator in that penicillin trial that was stopped early. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine because it was such an overwhelming benefit for the penicillin arm. There was such a connection to research that I met in a pretty famous and well-known and respected clinician, researcher in sickle cell space, Dr. Kwaku Ohene-Frimpong.
Yes.
He would come to the area every year and participate in a medical symposium, and I would go to that and just learn as much as I could about sickle cell disease. So at that point in time, my son seemed to have the best environment. He was in a nuclear family. Both his parents had college degrees. We had private insurance. We had this proximity and access to care. But ultimately, I think what happens perhaps in a lot of relationships is sickle cell not only takes its toll on the patient, but also really challenges the relationships around that patient. And so for us, the marriage ultimately broke up after, I guess, when my son was around age 5 or 6.
Yeah. Well, the stats on that are not, I think it's 80% of the relationships, not only sickle cell, but any chronic illness, a chronically ill child is born into the family, there's an 80% chance that that marriage will end. And as you said, it takes its toll on the nuclear family, on people hear me talk about this all the time. It felt to me like with Marissa, like my family was fell away like layers of an onion. It was like she would get sick early on, and then of course they would come, right, to see her, see about it. But then she kept getting sick, and then there were fewer and fewer family members showing up. Or they would ask me questions like, well, what did she do? And I'm like, well, she's breathing, basically. You know, I mean, how do you answer that? And I think that's one of the things that the sickle cell community, once we find it and we find each other, we form like family, because we're not running away. Does that make sense? We're not falling away. We're choosing to stay in and stay supportive.
I agree. I mean, I look at it this way. So much of what we do in sickle cell awareness is to let the general population know, both the majority population, the African-American population, know about the burden of disease, the incidence, the prevalence, that it's a genetic condition, that you receive a bad copy of the blood protein gene from each parent, et cetera. And then I've sort of concentrated a lot of my efforts more on disease education. So for those people that are dealing with the disease, the patients, the caregivers, what do they need to get access to care, to know the safeguards, the warning signs, and then also the hope of a future of better and more therapies. Mm-hmm. But I think there's another dimension, the psychosocial, where we sometimes kind of neglect and almost don't realize the pathology that happens in our emotions,
right,
around someone suffering. And it can kind of creep up on you unexpectedly. And I've had an incident, you know, a few years ago where my mother just unloaded a lot of the hurtful feelings that she felt that I couldn't control. I couldn't, you know, it's after the fact who I married and that our child had sickle cell disease, or it doesn't even make sense to talk about how we never really dealt with sickle cell disease in the good old days, or whatever nostalgic memories we hold on to. And so I think when you don't take off from the fight, when you remain present, you eventually accept the reality, you forgive yourself and others, and you press on and you try to make a difference.
Right. I had a moment yesterday where I was doing an interview yesterday, and it turned out very differently because we actually started talking about grief. And this is where we're very prominent therapist. And so we started talking about grief and, you know, these stages of grief. And I realized that with having a child with sickle cell, or again, any genetic illness, you are immediately thrown into that process of grief. You grieve.
True.
You grieve for, I mean, there's the loss, right? There's the loss of your idea. Now all parents, especially new parents, have an idea of what parenting's going to be like, right? And or what their kid's going to be like. And that varies because kids come here kind of as they are.
Right.
But when you have a child that has an illness, there are things that you know that you're going to not be able to experience. And
right.
There's two schools of thought. One is you just suck it up, and your kid's sick, and you have a sick kid. Oh, well. And the other school is, oh, well, my kid has this, but my kid's going to get to do everything and be everything, and we're just going to ignore the disease. Of course, until the disease rears its head and shows you that it's not going to be beaten in that way. We don't talk about it much. We don't talk about the grief of what early on to the parent of what we lose when we think of what could be, which I think would really help us. It would really help us if there was some mechanism, some class, something, you know, or that in our community there was a real push for professional help, or even if we just had support groups for the parents who are going through this so that we can better, I want to say, forgive ourselves early on. That's the word that keeps coming up, is to forgive ourselves early on and then get those skills that we need to help so that we can stay positive and stay strong and also understand what the rest of the family, why they're leaving us, because that's really how it feels. They're leaving us. I mean, I have a family, people hear me talk about the tribe. If one of the kids breaks a finger, you go to the ER, that ER is full of brown people with curly hair, and we're all kin for a broken finger. When Marissa's in the hospital, I can't tell you when one of them have visited Marissa in the hospital in the last 10 years. The weight of it, the weight of, is it going to be this time? There, I know they never say it. Well, they do say it to me. They were like, well, why did you let her do whatever it is I let her do? You know, I let her go to camp. I let her be a cheerleader. I let her go off to a university that, you know, to live on campus. And so what it is they are blaming me that somehow my letting her have a life, that I'm the reason that she's so sick.
Yeah, you know, I didn't want to interrupt you because it seems as though you were not only relaying it, but also processing all the perspectives. Because I know I went through an experience where my son would come to visit. I moved on with my life, had remarried, and so he would come for the summers and every other holiday. And this particular holiday, he had come, and I know I'm skipping a huge period of time chronologically, but I think it's on point with the topic, and that is forgiving myself for the lack of accomplishment, you know, seeing all the aspirations that I had before he was born pretty much evaporate because of how devastating sickle cell had been in his life. And unfortunately, while we had the benefit of the prophylactic penicillin, this was before the transcranial Doppler was being done, so we had no idea about his risk of strokes or how frequently he would have strokes. And so by this point in time, and this was probably around 2000, and he's maybe 11 or 12 years of age, he was in a wheelchair because he had had a pretty devastating stroke a few years earlier and was still not able to walk. So one particular evening, I'm getting him ready for bed, and this was also during a time when he had nightly iron chelation therapy that was through the subcutaneous, you know, needle in his belly. Right. So we're going through the nightly routine and so forth. And I guess I just had this distracted view or expression on my face. And my son asked me, Dad, what are you thankful for? And to tell you the truth, I didn't really think about my answer. I just told him something top of mind, whatever. I have no idea. I don't even remember what I said. But he shocked me with what he said. He said he was thankful for his wheelchair.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Now, for me, the wheelchair, I'm trying to compose myself here.
Yeah.
Reminded me of everything that was taken away.
Yeah.
You know, this happened, I don't know how many years ago, but it still hits me. And, you know, the resiliency that he showed taught me.
Yeah.
And so I never know when the emotions are going to come up, but, you know.
Yeah.
They're always there.
They're always there. We as parents, well, I know for me, okay, I just know for me that the guilt, the guilt sits there. It's always there, right? And my mom had us test it, you know, so, and we had a false negative. Okay, so, and I was married a Cuban guy, and we didn't know they even carried the trait then. We did not know these things. And then she was born, and my mom had kept my brother. My brother had a stroke at 3. He, 3 years old. He was partially paralyzed on one side. He had his IQ was probably that of, never passed that of maybe a 7-year-old. He was the sweetest, most wonderful, most loving soul. And everything in our household revolved around him. You know, we learned early on to look at his eyes to see that he needed water. We needed to go count the water bottles. I grew up knowing what to do to keep my brother healthy. You know, and my mother was determined he's going to live with us. We are going to take care of him. He's ours. And we did. Now, in doing that, what she did was she had made a life for him that was fairly narrow. So I think he did go to school for a little bit, you know, and but he was home, and he didn't go out in the rain. She had a lot of rules, all valid now that, you know, because we know that chilling's not good. We know change of temperature. We know about exhaustion. We know all those things. So what she was doing was absolutely right in trying to keep him from going into crisis. When my daughter was born, I had to make the choice. Well, I had 3 choices. I could raise her the way my mom wanted me to and the way she'd raised Teddy, or I could give her basically to my mom, who said to me, you need to go to school. So I'll just take her. I'm here with Teddy. I'll take her. Or it was, well, I'm going to be her mother, and we're going to take all the good stuff, but we're going to trust that things can be better and that she can do things. And that was the track that I took. Well, every time she would get sick and something would happen that was different than what happened to my brother, all my other brothers would look at me and my cousins and say, well, if you hadn't let her do these things, you know, she wouldn't be sick. But when Marissa and I are talking about things, she goes on and on about having been a cheerleader or having taken a trip to Europe. So I think we look at our loss, they are seeing their lives. Does that make sense? And making their way outside of our guilt.
I do. I mean, I think for me, he was showing me to accept reality and to appreciate blessings.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't thinking about his future. He was thinking about the moment. He was thinking about having a great, you know, Christmas season, visiting Dad. I was the one thinking about all the negatives that were years away and were never guaranteed. The successes, anyway, that I thought weren't going to happen, they weren't guaranteed anyway.
Right. Right.
It was just a reality check.
Yeah.
You know, I was glad to be able to attend his high school graduation. But kind of like your brother, you know, the devastation of the strokes kind of limited his intellect. Emotionally, he probably never really matured much beyond like a 14, 15-year-old. So he's got a very optimistic, you know, disposition. But he's also very keen in his faith, you know, came to his salvation early and embraces it and lives it and is unabashed. And it's just quite the spiritual challenge in a positive way whenever he would come to visit and we'd go to church and he would pull himself up out of his chair so he could stand and lean on something, the pew or the wall, and move and praise. I mean, it was just, no one could sit in his presence when they saw what he had to do. So, you know, I just have to realize that, you know, his value, his life is going to be totally different than what I expected, and he's going to have a much greater impact than I probably ever could have imagined.
Yeah. Well, what we're going to do now is we're going to take a break. This is Access Advocacy, and we're speaking with Bill Cummings. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment on thepowerofvoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Adrienne Shapiro on Access Advocacy via thepowerofvoices.com. Today, we're speaking with Bill Cummings about a lot of things. Right now, mostly parenting a child with sickle cell and that journey and what it looks like for us parents. We're going to change it a bit now, and we're going to talk about his work, which is very important. He has worked for many years in the pharmaceutical world, but he's also been truly, truly an advocate for those people living with sickle cell disease, along with parenting his son. So let's talk a bit about, how about we talk about the work that you're doing now with Prolong, is it?
Yes, Prolong Pharmaceuticals is a private biotech company out of New Jersey. And for a couple years, I've been helping them as a sort of the educational liaison on the value of participating in clinical trials, not just for their compound, which is known as sanguinate, but also there's a renaissance of drug development and research going on in sickle cell. And as a community, we need to participate in these trials so we can have a better selection, maybe combinations of therapies, such as what we see in other disease settings, like, you know, the cocktail therapies that are used in HIV and cancer, et cetera. But before I started working with Prolong, if I could go back a little bit, I started really just volunteering with the local sickle cell awareness group in my area and began to notice some gaps in the knowledge that some of the parents and patients had about their care and the rationale for it. And I began to see that there were also legislative activities happening in the state. New Jersey is a unique state because of, you know, how strong the drug industry is in the state, and therefore the federal delegation has a lot of connection to the industry and lots of support for their legislation. So it made sense to just get in and volunteer with some of those efforts, and not to get too much into the weeds, but there are all kinds of regulatory pathways that companies have to get drugs to the market, and some are not really suited for what they call rare diseases, diseases that affect patient populations less than 200,000. And with 100,000 patients in the U.S. with sickle cell disease, it's a rare disease. So I was aware, because of my industry experience, that there are all these private government partnerships that are happening for other disease settings, and I was trying to lend my efforts to bring some of those resources toward the sickle cell community. So much of the work I did initially as a consultant was pro bono. It was just helping out with various initiatives, and that put me in touch with probably four or five companies before I ultimately began consulting with Prolong. But I've done work for other companies as well, and I'm always open to help other advocates, other community-based organization leaders, figure out what they can do to make a difference. Because I really think, you know, it's a little cliche to act locally but think globally, but I think in the sickle cell world, every situation locally is somewhat similar but mm-hmm. also somewhat unique. And so there's mm-hmm. a big opportunity for people to get involved, to improve access, to increase education, and forward to kinds of partnerships that have and are thriving in other disease areas, and to make them happen in sickle cell disease so that we can benefit the future patients, so they can live a much different life than those who've come before.
Yes. I think the first time I met you was at one of the sickle cell meetings. I think it was at the meeting in Florida.
One of the FSCDR symposia?
Yes, yes. And what was really different was, because you were sort of standing there and there was a lot of discussion going on, you started going on about all these other possibilities, these other things that were in the pipeline that I had no idea coming from outside into the community. I had my eyes on a few things, but I remember you talking about all these other things that were going on, and you really had your pulse on research. And I guess at that moment, I kind of had some renewed faith that, yeah, something was going to happen, and it was going to happen soon. And because I was coming really from the stem cell research at that point, and knowing the battles that were ahead of us, and really the timeline for that being 10 to 15 years by the time we, and then there you were. I mean, you had a list of like six things. I remember, oh my God, I got to talk to this guy.
Well, thanks so much. Flattery will get you everywhere. But you know what? I thought we met at the FDA meeting with patients back in 2014.
Was it FDA?
I thought so. But back in 2014, as part of the guidance that the industry has to follow from FDA, known as the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, and section, I think, Generation 5, what was happening is the agency was directing the industry to do more work with patients to capture what they call patient-reported outcomes.
That's right.
How their disease makes them feel, and what are their expectations for future therapy. And the goal was to make, as part of the drug development process, more than just the efficacy and safety of the compounds that are regulated by FDA, but also the attempts of industry to capture what's meaningful for the patient. Because patients, especially in rare diseases, are often their best control, their best barometer of what their experience is and how it can improve and how it can change for the better. And so at that meeting, FDA had already met with, I think, several other patient groups, and so right. It was now time for FDA to meet with SCD patients, sickle cell disease. And so I know a delegation of us came down from New Jersey. We considered our opinions. We thought about how to contribute them in a way that would not just be a bitch session talking about that's wrong with the healthcare system and how few healthcare professionals understand sickle cell disease. We wanted to get beyond that to sort of get into the area of social research. In other words, describe things in a way that researchers could take that information and put it into the right format to then measure, in addition to their drug development, how the patients were experiencing improvement over time. At least that was the goal. Ultimately, I think the goal fell a little bit short because the FDA did not require companies. They just simply encouraged companies to develop these patient-reported outcome tools. Right. And in some cases, companies either went with their own creation. That's what GBT, Global Blood Therapeutics, out of San Francisco is doing. And in other cases, researchers, maybe not so much industry researchers, but academic researchers, are using what they call validated instruments that will capture the burden of disease and the change in attitudes and mental health with these existing research tools. PROMIS 57 is one that's being used.
Promise.
Ask Me is another one that's being used. So it was at that meeting that I think a lot of sickle cell advocates came together and began to sort of think about, well, what else can we do with respect to sickle cell advocacy, disease awareness, that probably wasn't being addressed by legacy organizations around the country.
Right.
And so, to me, I think that's probably where we first met.
I bet. I think you're right. I've been to so many meetings, and early on, I didn't know that my advocacy was going to be sort of what it is. It sort of evolved early on. I just thought, well, I've been avoiding really jumping into this world, mostly because of the legacy organizations. They were all very big and complex and required social skills, which I didn't think I had. And
you're very diplomatic. I think you do have a skill.
But and really, I was not a people person. I was always more, you know, the technology. And yeah, if I had known, I would have taken better notes on all of those early meetings and things I was at, because I think somewhere in there, there's a book. But
well, you know, and I want to be careful. I don't want to be too critical, but I think the legacy organizations, having existed for so long without there being branded therapies that were effective, did not have to rely in a partnership with industry to the same degree I think our current generation is.
Yes.
We're much more hopeful in those kinds of partnerships. And so as a result, there were missed opportunities to really, I think, educate the community, certainly the patients and caregivers, about the power that they have to influence and to be a part of the decisions and conversations that are happening around them and about them. And so that's what drew me to organizations like the, you know, Sickle Cell Warriors, Sickle Cell Community Consortium, because they seem to be contemporary and, to use a colloquial example, sort of more of a Malcolm X versus a Martin Luther King kind of approach to affecting change.
Yeah. Well, I think that, again, you mentioned it, it's timing, right? I mean, in my mother's day, people did not talk about sickle cell, right? And my mom was considered really not a crazy black woman in that sense, but a crazy black mom, because she would ask these questions of the doctors, right? And the docs were not used to being asked things. But when it came to my brother, she would ask a million questions. As the only girl, I was the one that went to clinic and stuff with her. The boys were off doing, you know, boy things, and I was with mom. And if that doctor did not answer her, she was not having it. And that came when it came to my brother. Now, her own health, she not so much, now that I think about it. I mean, she had a hysterectomy at 30-something years old, and when, you know, I was older, and I was like, well, Mom, why did you do that? And she's like, well, the doctor said I needed to do it. Now, she never in a million years would have done anything to my brother. You know what I mean? Let them come right near my brother without her fully understanding what was going on. At any rate, so that was one generation. Then for those of us, like now, we question. We're questioning what the docs are doing. We're questioning. We wanted to know. We're insisting. We're there. And now this next generation, our warriors, are really like saying, we want a seat at the table. I mean, they're seeing that they have real value and understand the whole thing with pharmaceutical companies. They are some people who are very compassionate. But ultimately, if whatever they're working on works, not only is it going to help the person who's sick, but it's going to help their bottom line. And there's value in that. And I'm really proud of them. I'm really, like, well done.
Yes. You know, and I think there's a good analogy. I mean, I think it comes from kind of like a religious model. But, you know, at that first age, everyone kind of does whatever they feel is right, and they're empowered. And then that second phase is you start to get very legalistic, and you have a certain process, and everything mm-hmm. has to be done by that process, or mm-hmm. it's not valid. Then there's a stage where you just kind of take on, you know, just innovation, and you're just doing mm-hmm. things that are different and new. Mm-hmm. And then finally there's a stage where you just kind of look at everything all over again and say, you know what, let's do a combination of what's innovative and what's tried and true.
Right, right.
And so for me, that's kind of what I began to think was then even lacking with sort of the contemporary organizations. They were so willing to do things innovative that they wouldn't do or consider what was useful and effective from the past. And so right. as much as possible, I try to reinforce, any and all things that are working.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, and it, there's an attempt right now to do a college tour, a historically black college and university tour, and things. That's not an entirely new idea. I think there have been efforts in the past,
mm-hmm.
but I think there's a unique role that college students can play because either as patients themselves or just simply involved in the advocacy fight, you can find out, you know, what research is happening in your vicinity. And there's a lot of overlap with the location of our HBCUs and where a lot of research is being done, both by academic as well as industry researchers. And that can be the cohort of advocates. You know, they're college or being college educated, so they're, you know, more comfortable with learning new things and delving into data and so forth, and perhaps forging relationships that could help the community connect with some of those researchers that are out there. And I think that's the kind of mobilization that would get the attention of industry. And to the extent that, you know, our tours and other ideas for collaboration become more experienced and successful, it makes it easier to draw additional industry support.
Yeah, I think we have to, again, I come from software, so I think we have to, as advocates, start looking at our model and going more towards, I think, of the lean model, which is basically just what you said. What works? What's innovative? We put it together, we try something, and it's a constant kind of evaluation. You know, is this working? Keep what's working and sort of move on and add as you're adding continually until you get to that point where this thing is really working, then that becomes standardized. And
yep.
And moving fast, I have, let's talk research. So there's a lot of money's being put into research, right? I did a calculation of the researchers I know and the research they've done, and actually the researchers have actually said to me many times over, you're right, if only we listened to the mothers, you were right. So millions of dollars in research to verify that what we mothers have been saying about our children is true. And so I look at that and I go, what could we have done with that money? Could we, certainly in the state of California, could we at this point have a center of excellence for treatment of people with sickle cell? You know, could we have, how many therapists could we have hired to help families navigate life with this illness? How many, you know, so I'm constantly being that thing in the back of my head is, I know research is important. I know we have to have the numbers. I know it's important. I know the data is important. I know that they have to do these projects so that they can get numbers, they can get the attention, the respect. But on the other hand, it makes me so angry that there are people that are in need and things we know, we just know because they're common sense, or we know because in other diseases there's funding for those things. And so those things are already in place for those people. And then I think the other thing is that with us being so close with so many treatments where we had nothing, we had one. So we had our hydroxyurea. But when you think of all the choices we have now, things that are so close, but that our people are so sick and are dying, and if they just had good care in place, those people that are dying could be alive, and more people who are alive could be healthy enough for these new treatments. And how do you resolve that? How do you resolve that? I mean, I would like it if every single research project that was funded had to have a component of some sort of practical thing that they offered back to the community. You know?
Well, to be clear, there is something that exists. It's called compassionate use. And that's when a company makes a drug available, even if it's experimental, for life-saving situations. Unfortunately, it's a trade-off. If a company is private and it's their first drug and their critical path for success and survival as an organization is to get a drug approved, then they're going to look at compassionate use as a trade-off that they may or may not be able to afford or can only afford up to some point. But these aren't decisions that are made in a vacuum. They're often made because of the response or expected response of a constituency. And so if it's important to a patient group and caregivers to have access to compassionate use, then they should make noise. They should demand that, and their mechanisms for such a thing to be done. And so what happens for the company practically is every patient that's being given compassionate use of a medication that's experimental, for the most part, that data is only useful to them as a company with the FDA for their safety data. They can't necessarily use that data set to get the drug approved. But there are ways and mechanisms that are out there. They aren't often volunteered, and sometimes it takes the demand of the patient group, and that's sometimes why I think our legacy organizations may have not made that a priority and instead made different choices to work with industry. So, I mean, these are delicate areas, but, you know, everyone, you know, reaches a point at which you can't back up anymore and you've got to go forward. And so I was at a Bio New Jersey event yesterday in New Jersey, and the keynote speaker was a woman who became an advocate because of her own battle with ovarian cancer. And as a result of getting educated and getting savvy and working the system, she'd been on a number of different protocols, and her life had been extended far beyond what was expected when she was first diagnosed. And so, you know, I think those are another type of example that we need to apply in sickle cell.
Well, I'm certainly about to make a dive into compassionate use, and we're going to document it, and we'll include as much as we can our audience and what happens with us. Marissa, as you know, is spending a huge portion of her life in the hospital. I've been asked by several people why we were not on list for any of the trials, and my comment has always been, well, she's too sick. She can't be transfused. I mean, there's a whole list of reasons why she would not be an ideal candidate for any of these phase 3 trials. Now, part of that is that from a practical standpoint, if you're a pharmaceutical company and you're doing these trials, you want really the healthiest sick people you can get, you know, because you want to get that patient sample in and you want to get approval. And someone had said to me, well, why don't you have her? And I'm like, well, she's too sick. And then it was there in Atlanta that it was mentioned to me that there was this compassionate use track. And actually, you talked to me about it too. You were the second person to mention it to me. And it took me a while to kind of get it in my head that, wow, we could go from no options, right, to maybe two options. And what a difference that would make. I haven't told Marissa about it yet because I don't want to get her hopes up. We're starting to do the preliminary discussions on what it looks like, what we would have to do. We're in California. We don't know if work is being done in California or if we'd have to go to another state. But we're going to go through this. We're going to document it so that our journey, although companies I know are different, but just our journey so that other families can see it and know about it and have it perhaps as an option. So I'm going to leave you the last minute. What would you like to leave us with, Bill?
Well, I'm very appreciative of this time that and interest that you had just to hear my story. The thing I would want to leave people with, besides just, you know, not giving up and maintaining hope for a brighter future, is something that we kind of alluded to. There is a lot of drug development happening in sickle cell disease. I was at a conference in New York City in September at which 9 companies presented various stages of research results. And we sometimes swing for the fences and we want a widely available cure, and that probably will occur with gene therapy in the future. But the one company that presented at this meeting, and the meeting was a symposium basically for the Wall Street audience, so that the people who have access to funding and capital can be apprised about this emerging area of development so that they might one day support it and help some of these companies get to the market or expand their markets. Because the fact is, while we have our own story and our social justice issues with respect to sickle cell disease in the U.S., no company is developing drugs for sickle cell disease to limit themselves to the U.S. market. The fact is, around the world, there's as many as 12 to 25 million people, it's estimated, that have sickle cell disease. And it affects lots of different nationalities, not just those of African descent. So Mediterranean, Middle Eastern, even Asian. They're all different variants of this hemoglobinopathy condition. And so there are huge markets that companies are developing. And so being aware of what's happening is really important. And so what I would recommend people do is go to a particular website. It was called SCD Forum. And you can look at the Twitter posts that occurred back in that event, which happened on September 14th. And you can see some of the reports that the companies made and the particular parties that are involved in this drug development struggle. And just stay educated, follow some of these companies, follow that community. I think it's at SCD Forum is the Twitter handle. And that's one way to start engaging in this particular fight.
Wow. Well, that is great. I'm going to start doing that more closely. I do have, from time to time, I've sent stuff there, but I'm going to go and do a deep dive. And I want to thank you. I mean, I'm always thanking you, but I want to thank you for this interview. I think it's going to be very helpful to our audience as well as our work. I have a feeling we'll be using parts of it in some of our workshops. Thank you. So
you're welcome. Thanks so much, Adrienne, and I wish the best. And I'm praying for Marissa.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And now we're going to have more options than just praying. Which
absolutely.
That's crazy. I think there's part of me that doesn't want to let me believe it. That probably doesn't make sense, but I think you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Bill, for joining us today on Access Advocacy. We'll be back in a moment on thepowerofvoices.com. Well, we're just about out of time today, but before we go, I wanted to let you know that you can learn more about our organization on our website, accessadvocacy.org, or on the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's AXIS advocacy.org. Join us again next Tuesday on thepowerofvoices.com at noon Pacific, or listen anytime on demand at accessadvocacy.org. You'll find all our programs there. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. Thank you for listening. Worship.